to come here and present some work. What I'm going to talk about in this talk is, I want you to imagine a particle that sets off in the early universe at some relativistic speed. And it comes flying towards us over billions of years, and we measure it. But this particle is not just obeying the standard rules of quantum theory. I want to consider what happens if it obeys a collapse model. So we know that a side effect of collapse models is that not only does the wave packet collapse, it also leads to increase in energy. It actually leads to diffusion in energy, and you'll end up with some distribution of energy. So suppose this particle that was emitted at some point in the early universe, or you could even consider some swarm of non-interacting particles at some definite energy. What does that distribution of energy look like now if we were to measure it? So in getting there, sort of point here. So I first want to give an overview of CSL. I'll not go into too much detail, but given that there's already been several talks on this. But I want to try and pick out some of the features that I want to consider in doing this relativistic calculation. And in particular, I want to show how the CSL model can be much simplified in the case where, first of all, the particle or the wave packet is very localized, and second of all, that it is a single particle wave function. I'll demonstrate that leads to a steady state solution. So you have the collapse effects, which are wanting to make the wave function smaller, but you also have the Hamiltonian that wants to spread it out. So you reach some point where they're balanced. And when you reach that state, the wave packet is essentially stable, but it diffuses in the phase space that defines its average momentum and its average position. So this will all be non-relativistic. What I'm going to argue is to do a relativistic calculation, all I need to do is take that non-relativistic model and assume that applies in the rest frame of the particle. Now, it sounds like a really trivial thing to do almost, but I would like to try and justify it at least by giving an overview of relativistic models. And after all, if you take non-relativistic quantum theory and just transform it to another frame, you don't get the Dirac equation. But I want to try and argue that at least in this case, it's a valid thing to do. So first of all, let me just talk about stochastic processes. They're represented by a stochastic differential equation. You have this drift term, and then you have this extra term, which is an increment of Brownian motion. So if these are just constants, mu and sigma, you'd have some average drift behavior, and you have some kind of stochastic behavior on top of that. So if you want to introduce some fundamental noise into your physical theory, this is the way to do it. Or it's a good way to do it, at least. And I mean, here this is just a random variable. There's nothing stopping making that a vector. There's nothing stopping making that a state vector. And also, I can make mu and sigma depend on the state vector and operators. And for example, I could imagine sigma being some function of the state in such a way that the stochastic variation, volatility, is large when the state is an eigenstate of some operator, It's small when the state is an eigenstate of some operator, but large when it's not an eigenstate. And that's precisely what you do in the CSL model. So if you imagine, if this state is an eigenstate everywhere of this number density operator, then this stochastic term will go to zero. So it's happy in that state. If, on the other hand, it's not an eigenstate of n, this term will be non-zero. It essentially jiggles the state around in Hilbert space, and it will do that until it finds its a point where it's happy, i.e. where it is an eigenstate of this operator. This other term here is there basically to
that
make...
That operator has continuous spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So that's a non-normalizable eigenvector you're talking about.
It doesn't work in such a simple way in this case. I'm just trying to give a feel of how these stochastic differential equations work to affect state collapse. So this the drift term in this case is chosen specifically so that if you ask what is the process for the norm of the state, it's actually constant. It's a remarkable property of this equation that even though it's got this stochastic term, the norm is one. Assume you set it one initially. So as we've seen, this is the smeared number density operator, this is some Gaussian function. And B is a field of Brownian motions. There's a Brownian motion at every single point in space.
Excuse me, when you got interrupted, you were just about to make a comment about the second term and the first
The drift term. Yeah, I think I said it actually. That the point of that term is that it when you calculate what the process for the norm is, you find that it's constant, which is exactly what you want.
I see. Good.
Okay. So now I want to simplify this equation. I want to try and get it in a form which is much easier to understand. So. First of all, I want to assume that the state describes a particle that is highly localized about y equals zero. So in this case, these operators will only give a non-zero result very close to y equals zero. So in this expression, I can approximate y being close to zero. So I can essentially do this. And that's valid when the length scale, which is 1 over the root of alpha, is much greater than the length scale associated with the state. So I'm assuming that the state is much more localized than the length scale of the CSL model. That isn't actually a problem. So this is a case where that works well. This is a case where y is a bit too large. Next thing I'm going to assume is that the state is a single particle state. So if you do that, you can just define your position state operators by this. Your position state vectors by this, and your position operator by this. So this is essentially the wave function. And if you act with this on the state, you find that you're just multiplying the wave function by x. So you make all these substitutions, and you actually recover this equation. So this, in Angelo's talk the other day, he was calling this the quantum mechanics with universal position localization. It's also, in the literature, just called quantum state diffusion, which is a bit cheeky, perhaps, given that you could consider CSL also to be a quantum state diffusion. You get this quite complex expression for W, which is my stochastic process, but you can actually show, so this is an integral over the Brownian motion field. You can actually show that this satisfies the conditions of being a Brownian motion, or a Wiener process. So what I've tried to argue is that if this particle is in a localized state, if it's a single particle in a localized state, I can approximate the CSL model by this much simpler model, which makes it clear that there is a position localization going on.
Danny, how do you get the integral over time?
What, here?
Yeah.
Oh, this is just to define this as a process. So you, an increment of this would just be without the integral. Okay, so I think the best way to sort of see how this equation behaves is just to simulate it. So first of all, just to give a frame of reference, this is a double slit experiment without collapses. So we started off with two Gaussian peaks. I'm just letting this evolve with the non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. And you can see that you get this interference pattern. Like so. So now this is the case with collapses. So you can see there's some stochastic motion going on. You can also see there's some green dots appearing. These are actually, I mean, when you put this equation on a lattice, you have to discretize it. So that allows you to actually interpret the collapse terms in terms of a Gaussian projection on the state. And the dots are where the centers of those Gaussian projections are occurring. No, it's a time simulation. Some might happen in front. So this is X and this is Y. So it's just a two-dimensional representation. They're not happening in the future. They're just happening in a position which is in front of the wave function. So this is a sort of a schematic of how Marcus, I guess, is testing these models. In this particular example, that's not actually collapsing fast enough.
But still, also surprised by the fact that so many green points outside of the wave function, so to say. So it collapses somewhere where you wouldn't expect anything.
Yeah, that's because the Gaussian projection is extremely wide. So. So the profile for where the probability density function for where those collapses occur is also very wide.
Is it the case, I mean, maybe we just can't see because of the blue, is it the case that the density of the green dots in the blue area is higher than it is outside?
There are some there. I mean, there's a little bit more dense around there, I think, yeah.
Shouldn't it be a lot more? I don't understand. The value of the wave function is much higher in those regions.
But the way you determine the probability density function for where the collapses is actually
right.
A convolution of this very wide Gaussian
right.
with the sharp.
I see.
So it's actually very spread out.
Oh, I see. I understand. Right. Good. Thank you.
So this also illustrates the difference between the ontologies that we have. I mean, I don't think I mentioned this is the wave function amplitude squared that I'm representing here. So this more or less would be the matter density of stuff. Whereas these dots would be the flashes, Bell's flashes. Okay, so if I left that simulation running for a while, what you'd eventually find is that the state ends up in this Gaussian state. So these are the expectation values of x and p, and these satisfy this closed set of equations. So they describe a diffusion in phase space. You've got this term, which just basically tells you what the velocity is, and you've got some additional stochastic behavior. It's essentially a Brownian motion other than that.
What if in initial condition the state was having a very complicated microscopic structure? Then because of the Gaussians you get this kind of bit of the state, which part I understand, but still there should be some microscopic structure inside that Gaussian, because you see when you do those collapses, they affect things far away, they get rid of things far away. But like an internal structure, especially a very microscopic structure, is not going to be affected very much by those collapses. So how come you say that it's Gaussian instead of saying that it's some complicated thing that is bounded by Gaussian?
The microstructure might not necessarily be affected much by the collapses, but it would be affected by the Hamiltonian part of the evolution.
Oh,
so that would just diffuse the wave packet, those features at least.
I see.
So again, you have this closed set of equations which describe a diffusion of this wave packet in phase space. And here, so this is the limiting width squared of the wave packet. So that's given by my diffusion parameter, which is some function of the CSL parameters and the mass, and it takes this amount of time to reach it. So this is just a phase space Wigner representation of what that Gaussian packet looks like. It's slightly diagonal. That's because of the I term there. And this is what the phase space trajectory looks like. You see that also has this slightly diagonal feature, and that is because positive movements in X are correlated with positive movements in P. So this is essentially a very small close-up of what the behavior of this packet is.
Why would positive movement in X correlate with positive movement in P? I didn't understand why you think that positive movement in X correlates with positive movement in P.
It's basically because they have the same Brownian motion process.
Okay.
So if this increment happens to be positive here, it also positive there.
Well, but intuitively P is just a frequency. So why would an increase in frequency shift you to the right?
This is just what the model is telling us. I mean,
where is that coming from? I mean, one wouldn't expect the velocity and the position to be correlated. Why in this model are they correlated?
A change of position and change of velocity.
Can I think about that and get back to you? Because I think that's probably a deep point, which I'm not entirely sure.
What was the question there?
Is there a deeper underlying reason why stochastic changes in momentum and position should be correlated?
Well, you're just one noise there.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the simple answer. There's just one noise. So. So it can't be otherwise. Yeah. Okay. So in 3D, this is what the diffusion parameter is. So,
I think we'll let the speaker go on because I'm worried about him giving them enough time to finish.
Okay, so these are the parameters of the CSL model. This is the collapse strength, and this relates to the width of the collapse width. And the original GRW parameters gave these values, which relate to this value of D. And we're also pretty sure, based on experiment, that this should scale as the mass. So that means that you can work out what the steady state values for a bunch of different things are. So a neutrino, for example, its steady state is 1,500 kilometers, and it takes 400 years to reach it. That, of course, assumes that the length scale of the CSL model is greater than 1,500 kilometers, which might not necessarily be the case. An electron is 14 meters, a proton 5 centimeters, ion nucleus 2 millimeters, and a 10,000 atomic unit cluster would be 50 nanometers. This relates to the center of mass. Okay, so now let me start to think about, so what we've been doing so far is non-relativistic. I want to start to consider about what we need to do in adding special relativity. So first of all, I think we need to work with relativistic quantum fields, given that they are essentially the result of decades-long challenge of trying to combine relativity with quantum theory. It doesn't necessarily make sense to use a relativistic particle theory. We might as well use the state of the art. We're going to require a covariant expression of the state evolution, essentially so that different observers agree on what they expect to happen and what happens. There should be no preferred frame or foliation. So in particular, I wouldn't want to use a frame or foliation even if that couldn't be observed, just because it's sort of against the spirit of relativity. And of course, no faster than light signaling. So I'm sure a lot of people would argue that in order to advance, you need to take a path integral approach here. But what I want to consider is an approach where you consider states on hypersurfaces advancing through space-time, simply because I think when you're considering collapses, it's the most natural way to understand how a state is evolving as a result of some collapse-type interaction. So the possible approach I want to outline is that the state of an extended system is defined along a space-like hypersurface. And a state history should be defined with a particular foliation of space-time. But state histories given with respect to alternate foliations should be merely different descriptions of the same thing.
Let the speaker go on for a while.
So in particular, if I choose two different foliations and they share a leaf, then the state defined on that leaf should be independent of those two foliations. So within that approach, I'm going to assume that this type of evolution. So I have my state assigned to one hypersurface sigma 1. I want to advance it to another hypersurface sigma 2. So I just use this unitary operator. So this is the interaction Hamiltonian. Any quantum field operators would be Heisenberg operators under the free Hamiltonian. And in order that this be a covariant description, I have to have that this interaction Hamiltonian commutes with itself at space-like separation. So this essentially means that if I advance at a point here and then I advance at a point here, it doesn't make any difference if I did it in the other order. So this is a microcausality condition that essentially gives consistency across different foliations. This interaction Hamiltonian must also be a Lorentz scalar. So I'm going to also consider this model to be a discrete model in the sense of more in line with a kind of GRW type model. So I'm going to assume that there are some, so if you recall in the CSL, we have some continuous stochastic field. Here I'm just going to assume that there is a sprinkling of Poisson distributed points in space. And that when the hypersurface crosses one of those points, it simply undergoes this GRW-style collapse. So it undergoes the action of some Gaussian operator, where this is some random variable. So this is the picture to have in mind. I have this foliation. I have my Poisson-distributed set of hits in space, which are, of course, it's a Lorentz invariant distribution. So when these hypersurfaces evolve without hits, they just follow the unitary evolution. When they cross a hit, this one of these collapses occurs. So if I just assume that this collapse operator takes this general form, and this is some operator to be specified, then what conditions do I have to apply to this? Well, first of all, N must also be a Lorentz scalar, just like the interaction Hamiltonian, in order that the theory be covariant. But you also have another couple of microcausality conditions. It has to commute with itself at space-like separation. It has to commute with the interaction Hamiltonian. So one thing you can try is just that this number density operator is a scalar field operator. And this, in fact, Philip Pearl did very early on, soon after the CSL model, in a similar kind of relativistic framework. But the problem there is that I think there's two problems with this. One is that this has creation operators on the right-hand side of the expression. So if you act this operator on the vacuum, it will just create particles. So that's one problem. The other problem is it's infinitely sharp. It just acts at one point in space. If you recall the CSL model, you have to smear out this number density operator. Since this just collapses at one point in space, it leads to a discontinuity in the field, and therefore you have infinite energy. So they may be two different ways of understanding the same idea, I'm not sure. So you can look for all kinds of possible ways of satisfying these constraints. And this is one way that I've come upon, which is to define this quite unusual looking quantum field. So you can define it in terms of annihilation creation operators, but here this is a four-dimensional delta function. So what this is describing, in fact, is an independent degree of freedom at every point in space-time. Whereas a quantum field defines modes on some time slice, this is actually defining a quantum field over the whole of space-time. So it's a non-dynamical thing. It's just if you excite it, the influences aren't going to propagate into the future. It just exists. So you could define one particle excited states in this way and so on. So the point of doing that is that then I can define a number density operator which looks very much like the CSL one. And for that matter, a smeared field operator. And because this field doesn't have any dynamical properties, the number density commutes with itself anywhere. So I choose any two points in space-time. And the same for the smeared field operator. And the commutation of the field operator with the number density operator is this. So it's this overlap of these two smearing functions. So all I have to do to ensure that they're zero, that the commutator between the field operator and the number density operator is zero for space-like separated x and x prime, is to make sure that they're only non-zero in these domains.
So can you say where did these functions come from, or these are postulated?
Yeah. So these functions, they must be defined as part of the theory. This is one of the points I want to make, and one of the reasons for looking at this model in a bit of detail, is try and understand in what way it actually refers to the rest frame state or the local rest frame state of the field itself. But let me carry on. I'll talk about that in a second. So this is how the model would work. My interaction Hamiltonian is a interaction between some quantum field operator and my field operator for this space-time field. So what I can imagine as my hypersurface sweeps through space-time, it's exciting the space-time field by this interaction. And then the random hits are just this operator where this is the number density. So what that is doing is reading off what the number density is. So it's more or less like the behavior of this space-time field is like a cloud chamber. As my quantum fields sweep through space-time, they're leaving a stain on this space-time field. The collapses are happening on the space-time field, and because there is some entanglement between the two, it induces a collapse on the quantum fields themselves. So I just want to, this relates to the choice of the functions G and F, and I just want to formalize the idea that there must be some locally preferred frame. So first of all, just assume that a collapse event is associated with some space-time point. And then I'm going to assume that my initial state is approximately a one-particle state in a very spread-out state. So it's more or less a pure momentum state. And let's suppose this collapse leads to a localization at x. This localization can't be precise because otherwise such a state would have an infinite energy. It must have some spread in space. And that spread must be different for different observers. So in other words, this collapse event must pick out a preferred frame in which the particle is localized. So the obvious choice is the local rest frame. So how does that work? So this was my interaction between my quantum field and my space-time field. And this is just a suggested way in which the form of this function, a form this function might take. So first of all, it's only non-zero in the forward light cone. And so here I've got the energy momentum tensor. And K is just some parameter. So one thing I can do here, so this point is the point Z. For any point X that I choose in this future light cone, I can use that to define the time direction. In which case, only the 0,0 component of the energy momentum tensor contributes. That, of course, is the energy. So I will get a decay in that direction. Now, if the direction X is chosen such that you're very far away from the rest frame of the particle, so you're perhaps like near the edge of the light cone, then the particle is going to have high momentum, very large energy, and it's going to decay quicker in that direction. So what this does is it gives you a way in which this function decays, making reference only to the state of the field at that point Z, and makes this function decay and leave a distribution which represents points which are close to the particle from the point of view of its rest frame. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that this theory has to have reference to the rest frame of the particle. And you can also see that in Tomolka's relativistic model. So this is just an outline to explain how that works. So this concerns a relativistic particle. This might be its approximate trajectory. And the wave function is defined on this hypersurface. So this is a model of discrete collapses. I have flashes occurring. This is the previous flash. The next flash is determined to be a proper time given from some Poisson distribution away from the last flash. So it's defined on this hyperboloid. And the way you affect the collapse is simply to evolve this state unitarily to this hyperboloid. And then the wave function on that hyperboloid defines the probability distribution for where the collapse is going to be. So you can see that this is essentially like looking at the rest frame collapse from a moving observer. So essentially all that happens is that the collapse length scale gets Lorentz contracted.
Can I ask just this question was occurring. I was hoping you were going to bring up the Tomolka model because I'm not sure I understand what you just said. In the earlier on, you were saying, look, since the collapse can only look sort of normal in one frame, it effectively picks out a preferred frame. But what occurred to me when you said that is, no, the Tomolka model seems like a counterexample. That is, the hypersurface along which the collapse looks normal in the Tomolka model is this hyperboloid, you know, asymptotic to the future life cone.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't pick out any frame. That's a Lorentz invariant surface. I mean, I must be misunderstanding something, but
yeah. So imagine if now I'm looking at this picture. And I'm looking at it, suppose this red line was actually vertical.
Right.
So that I'm in the rest frame of this particle.
Right.
Then I would see a collapse length scale associated with the collapse in my frame. But to see this, it's just like looking at it from a different observer's frame. And I see that collapse, Lorentz contracted.
Okay, I don't want to stop us now. I'm confused, but I'll ask you.
Okay, so I'm going to leave all the relativistic models behind now. And the only thing I wanted to take from that really was that you have to, or at least in these examples, you need reference to some local rest frame. So in light of that, it seems perfectly valid to just assume that the CSL model works in the rest frame of the particle. All I need to do then is transform these set of diffusion equations to some cosmological frame. So bar just refers to the rest frame of the particle. Tau is the proper time, so this would be the time parameter. So near the particle rest frame, the energy just satisfies the non-relativistic energy formula. And then I can use the Itô formula just to determine what the process of E is, because I know what the process for PI is. And I just find this equation. So this is just the non-relativistic process for the energy. And if I'm in the rest frame, P is zero, I can just neglect it. I'm just left with that. So straight away you can see that the energy is increasing as a result of this diffusion in space-time. So now I want to transform to, say, the cosmological frame. I assume that this particle is traveling in one particular direction, and then I can just use the Lorentz transformation for energy momentum. Also assume that the velocity is more or less the velocity of light. I know what these processes are in the particle's rest frame, so I just substitute them. And this is just the energy process from the cosmological frame. The problem is it's represented in the proper time of the particle itself. So what you need to do is a Lorentz transformation of the coordinates also. You have to worry a bit about the fact that this particle is diffusing in space as well. But in actual fact, you can just ignore that and assume that the cosmological time is just the Lorentz factor times the proper time. If you just integrate this over a finite amount of time, what you find is this noise just integrates away. So this is my relativistic energy process. It's not actually that different from the non-relativistic case. Instead of a root 2 there, I think you get 2 in the non-relativistic case. So just to make it slightly more general, one thing you can do is add a friction term to account for the fact that the universe is expanding. So this is just the Hubble constant and the energy. So I think it's worth pointing out in this case that if you're worried that collapse models don't conserve energy, then neither does it in an expanding universe. So this equation is actually known as the Cox-Ingersoll-Ross process. It's used in finance to describe a short rate. It has this interesting feature that if just considering the drift terms here, if E becomes large, then this negative drift starts to dominate, and it brings the energy down. If E is small, then this dominates and the energy increases. So it actually reaches a steady state. For this application, that doesn't actually happen because the Hubble constant is so small. But that's the reason why that's useful in finance is you tend to expect the your interest rates to stabilize around some level. So the other advantage of this being a well-known equation is that it's been solved, and you can write down the probability distribution or the equation that the probability distribution function satisfies just by standard methods. So it's worth pointing out here that there was a paper by Faye Dauker, Joe Henson, and Raphael Sorkin that considered diffusion on a causal set of a trajectory. And they arrived at a probability distribution function on general grounds of Lorentz invariance, or an equation, a forward equation. And this is exactly the same in the limit that the velocity of the particle is approximately c. So it gives you a little bit of confidence that at least haven't made any mistakes.
In the limit that I didn't quite catch what you said, so it's the same only in some limit?
Yeah, it's the same in the limit that that the velocity of the particle is close to the velocity of light. So a kind of ultra-relativistic limit. So I'm not sure you could actually solve the forward equation if you didn't make that approximation. So you can solve that equation, you end up with this. This is a modified Bessel function of the first kind of second of order 2. So these are just coefficients. And you can find what the expected value of the energy is at time t. It's just the initial energy plus this term to do with the collapses. And similarly, the variance in the energy is given by this expression. So you'll notice that there's no effect of the Hubble constant. That's just much smaller it's neglected in these expressions. So this is what that distribution function looks like. If you scale the variables by m over dt, the only thing that affects the shape of this function is just the ratio between the initial energy and this this energy increase due to collapse. So when they're approximately the same, it looks like this. You get this kind of distribution. When the initial energy is much larger than the effect of collapse, you get a more something which approaches a delta function. So just to put in some real numbers, and I've made a very, very aggressive estimate here that perhaps needs updating in light of yesterday's talk by Marcus. But and this is taken from Tomolka's paper on parameter diagrams. So the bound from C60 puts a bound on my diffusion parameter, like that. And so that gives me these expressions for the average energy and the variance. So this needs to be significant in relation to the initial energy. And the problem is if the particle is initially traveling close to the speed of light, then this will be several times at least the rest energy. So this is a very small correction. So it's a rather disappointing result, but at least gives an idea of how you can do relativistic calculations. So if a particle is traveling at 99% the speed of light, then E naught would be about 10, of order 10 rest energies. So this is my summary. We've worked in the localized single particle limit of CSL. So, and hopefully I explained there that in that limit, CSL approximates to a much simpler model, the quantum mechanics with universal position localization or quantum state diffusion. Also that there is a steady state solution for the wave packet, which diffuses through phase space. It's this diffusion which leads to, this leads to diffusion of kinetic energy. It actually leads to an increase in kinetic energy. So you often hear that it's the collapse of the wave function constraining it in position space, spreading out momentum space, which is actually responsible for the increase of energy. In this case, you actually end up with a localized state, but it's the diffusion through phase space which leads to an increase in energy. So I've tried to argue that the relativistic equations, the non-relativistic equations hold in the particle rest frame, and that you can therefore just transform to the cosmological frame with Lorentz transformation. And rather disappointingly, you find very narrow spreading of the energy distribution. So if you wanted to measure this in astrophysical observation, you'd need a very precise source from the early universe to do that. Okay, I think I'll wrap up there. Thanks.
You said that you may violate relativity locally. You have local preferred frame, but actually, I think you also do it globally when you introduce the hypersurface, because, like you said yourself, you need the hypersurface in order to define a state. Now, even if you talk about a local state, you still define the local state with respect to the global hypersurface. So, deep down, you violate relativity globally.
You're specifically referring to this?
Yeah.
But okay, yeah. So this was something I didn't point out. what you need to ensure is that this is some invariant quantity. So one way to do that is to make is to define this expectation on the past light cone hypersurface. So that's okay. Or something arbitrarily close to that limit.
But in order to define the operator to mean you need to define other operators like creation operators and annihilation operators. But now, like at first you define creation and annihilation operators for momentum. Then you do the transformation to get the ones for position. But like creation and annihilation operator for momentum rely on a global hypersurface. So even if TMU is invariant, it's still in order for this to be defined, like in order to define it, you need to start with the hypersurface and the geometric construction is not invariant. Then after that, you can have a TMU that is invariant, but at first you start with something not invariant.
So I'm saying that you need to, if you use a hypersurface which is arbitrarily close to the past light cone, That is invariantly defined about the point Z.
So you use past light cone as the definition of a hypersurface.
Not generally, just for the purpose of defining this smearing function. Can I just highlight? And this is just one suggested form. There may be other ways to do this.
Adrian, yeah, I think you maybe answered this during talking at the end. I was still trying to get straight. It's an intuition rather than a rigorous result that you can do your calculations in the particle rest frame and get the correct answer. Is that right? Or
it's not a rigorous result. Yeah. But I think on the basis of examining the these two relativistic models, it seems valid certainly in a single particle case that you can do that. I mean, in the single particle case. That seems to be what's happening. That you're using the local rest frame to define the collapse frame.
So about this correspondence between your sort of fusion of momentum and energy and the one that I and Clay and I and Raphael came up with. So you said you can derive that they're the same thing in the ultra relativistic limit somehow.
Yeah.
But then can't you apply the same kind of argument that we did? Well, if it's got to be Lorentz invariant and you want just to have the only Lorentz invariant, just the very limitation of Lorentz invariant restricts the form of that thing down out of that limit. And so if you know, can't you say something like you use your argument to fix the relationship between the diffusion parameter and your GRW type parameters, but then you just use a general argument of Lorentz invariants to say what happens out of that limit? Does that make sense to you?
I'm not sure it does. It's a completely different approach. I've tried to just assume. All I've tried to assume is the non-relativistic equations of CSL, and arrive at this formula. Whereas I think what you did was to just say, well, if I have some general diffusion in phase space, what form must it take? Yeah. And you arrived at that forward
the
equation.
So it seems to be true of your model.
But also, were you able to solve the forward equation for yours as well?
No.
Okay.
So
this is the advantage of taking the ultra-relativistic limit is that you can find a solution.
Any more questions? David, yes.
This may be too open-ended, but it would. Could you, just to give me a little more of an orientation, contrast your general approach to making a relativistic version of such a theory with, say, Tomolka's approach?
Well, the fundamental difference is that I've used a field approach, so
right.
Quantum fields.
Right.
So which is more in line with the CSL type approach?
Right. I mean, that's fair enough. Although in the relativistic version you gave us presumably Tomolka could try his kind of thing out with fields as well. I mean,
I've never seen a GRW thing in fields.
Right.
So I don't
think you could. But also the collapse, the flashes in Tomoka's model are associated with individual particles.
Right. No, that's so, definitely true. Yeah. Here's more of the thing I had in mind. Tell me, the two of the questions one had about how you could possibly make make any of these theories Lorentz invariant. One was, the Gaussian structure isn't invariant under Lorentz transformations. How did Tomoka solve that? He put the Gaussian on this invariant hyperbola, okay? Mm-hmm. So first question, what's the analogous trick in your theory to make that?
Yeah, it's this. So yeah, okay, it's basically, so I could try to define this smearing function as a Lorentz invariant function, but that would go off infinitely.
Sort of stand in for his invariant hyperbola toward the future.
Yeah, I think
right.
So.
Right, okay,
yeah.
Good. Second question. The price he had to pay for doing that was a failure to be Markovian. Is something analogous happening here?
Yeah.
Just evoke that from you.
Okay, so I said that this has to be defined invariantly. So it has to. One way of doing that is to choose the expectation under the past light cone hypersurface at the point z.
I see.
So whereas z is actually defined on any hypersurface. So if on a lot of hypersurfaces.
Okay.
So every time you want to advance the point at the point z in a given foliation, you need to refer to this past hypersurface.
I see. So it's not even. And you mentioned this to me at dinner the other night. So there's a way in which it's even more non-Markovian than, because he only needs to refer to the last collapse. You always need to refer back to this initial hypersurface.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
And I wonder whether you could perhaps eliminate that the non-Markovian. Anyway, by just making this. A continuum. I'm not sure whether that could be done, but if you
by making what a continuum?
By making the rather than having discrete flashes,
have a
continuum of flashes.
Good. Thanks. Yeah.
Also, it's worth pointing out that this model can't support interactions between particles as well.
Right.
Whereas that isn't an issue in the field approach.
Good. Thank you.
So if I understood right. At the moment, looking at the numbers, the analysis is a little bit discouraging in terms of experimental tests. But accepting it's discouraging, what's the best place to look? Is it, have you tried to pick through that?
What, for relativistic effects?
Well, for tests of the energy diffusion. Have any idea of the cosmological...
This goes back to what Angelo was discussing in his talk. So things like intergalactic warming of protons.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Also the, I guess you could consider the germanium experiment as well to be a heating effect.
This is CSL makes particles move randomly.
Yeah.
So if they're charged particles, then they'll accelerate.
Yep.
And if they accelerate, they radiate. And if they radiate, you can see that radiation. And so my student, Chi Cha Fu, analyzed this in the germanium experiment where 1s electrons were looked at between 6 and 16 keV. He said, let's not look at that. Let's look at the outermost electrons, which are almost free, because the theory was a theory of how free particles would behave. And so they're almost free, so let's do that. And calculate the radiation. And there, what is the best limit, apparently, according to Angelo, lambda is less than 10 to the minus 11 inverse seconds, comes out of that. There was an argument by Steve Adler that what Chicha did not take into account was that the protons in the background protons in the lattice would also move, and that would cancel it. But Angelo says that that's been retracted. Someone did a more careful calculation, one of his students or he himself, and so that number 10 to the minus 11 is that limit is there, and So that would certainly be, by many orders of magnitude, the best limit on lambda so far. And Angela, maybe you say something more about this would tend to exclude Steve Adler's lambda of 10 to the minus 8, governed on the principle that if you have a photographic plate which sees an interference pattern, you shouldn't be able to put that in pocket and walk around for hours with an uncollapsed wave function. It should collapse right away. And so that put a much stronger limit because very few particles are separated in the photographic process, and that would have bothered Steve, but go ahead.
Yeah, if you use the CSM model with a white noise, that actually rules out Steve Adler's idea.
His parameter value.
As I said in my talk, if you go to non-Markovian noise or general noise, which seem more feasible at the end of the day, then if you consider this noise as real noise and not as intrinsic property of nature, then white noise is an existing nature, basically. Then if you take a reasonable noise, the reasonable cutoff, then you display compatibility with that as well.
Okay, so, I mean, I realize there are lots of ifs and buts and different models, but as broad summary, it's fair to say terrestrial experiments are doing better than cosmological ones look like doing at the moment.
I think that's so.
What was it saying?
Terrestrial, especially Marcus Arndt's experiments, which are the best thing.
At the moment, they do. It's not clear whether, if you take a PhD student work for 3 years on cosmology of CSL, then it's not clear what comes out.
A disappointed student.
Disappointed student. it's a nice theoretical physics. Yeah. Actually. But so far, the experiments are the best.
So I think we'll thank the speaker very much.